so nice to be back here again. I remember every time I leave here, I say, I don't want to go. I've only been here a day and I'm having that feeling already. It's just such a nice space, and just I feel so cared. Really appreciate that. Just the care, it goes into everything. So just thank you all for that. And I also feel very resonant with the tradition here. My own background comes from a very similar tradition. I got involved with TM, Transcendental Meditation, but that comes from the same Shankaracharya tradition, slightly different lineage. Is there something wrong with my mic, or is it? Okay. So I was, in my spiritual upbringing, was brought up with the Gita, the Upanishads, with Advaita. So again, I feel very at home here for that. But when I started, I never thought I'd be speaking at an ashram. You know, back in my youth, ashrams were places where people lay on beds of nails and shoved spikes through their cheek and held one arm up in the air till it withered, that sort of stuff. I was a scientist, mathematician, and loved it, and still do, and studied maths and theoretical physics at Cambridge. And yet in the background of my mind, there was always an interest in consciousness and things. But I'd rejected religion totally. When I was 13, I was brought up Anglican in the Church of England. And you go through, about 13, you go through the process of confirmation, they call it. For me, it was a process of deconfirmation. I realized that the Nicene Creed was actually a creed. It was something you meant to believe in. You meant to sign off on it. You know, I believe in one God, the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, blah, 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 and his only begotten Son, born of a virgin. It's like, I thought it was just stuff you chanted. And when I realized I was actually meant to sign off on this as a belief, it's like... And my parents were fairly understanding and said, that's okay. I said, I'm not going to church anymore. And they said, fine. Although years later, my mother said to me, I never believed that stuff either, really. So I grew up as a scientist, but in the back of my mind was always this interest in the mind and consciousness, and realizing that science was never going to really answer the questions about consciousness. I'd reached the stage in theoretical physics where I could solve Schrödinger's equation for the hydrogen atom, which for most of you, unless you're a physicist, is just meaningless. It's actually fascinating. It means from pure mathematics, you can start deducing the properties of hydrogen, a physical substance. It's a great sort of intellectual achievement of quantum physics to be able to do that. And from there, you can go on much more complex. You can do the Schrödinger's equation for helium, much more complex. And then it occurred to me, you know, the universe began, well, not with hydrogen, began just with energy, but hydrogen was the first element, and hydrogen evolved into other elements, which evolved into more complex molecules, and those more complex molecules eventually gave rise to life, and life evolved and evolved, and here was I, a product of that evolution, studying hydrogen. Like, how come hydrogen had evolved to the point where hydrogen could solve its own equation? And I started thinking, this is weird. Because there's nothing in modern science that predicts that consciousness should ever arise. There's nothing that predicts consciousness. The universe should go on perfectly well without consciousness, without our being aware of it, without our understanding, without our knowing. It should all just unfold without consciousness. So I got fascinated by how come there was consciousness in the universe? How come I was conscious and not just some biological robot? And I thought then, well, first of all, I thought philosophy might help me, but I discovered that all philosophy was at Cambridge in England was the study of dead philosophers. And I wanted to sort of do philosophy, get my hands in philosophy. So that was no good. And then I thought, well, psychology. So I took a degree in neuroscience thinking, you know, the study of the brain, this will tell me about consciousness. It was hardly mentioned in the whole degree. They weren't interested in consciousness. I learned a lot about memory and neurons and how they work and how the brain works and all this stuff. Fascinating stuff, but nobody's really interested in consciousness. Except, you know, you put a few electrodes on the brain and you can sort of get a very dim picture of what's going on. And then I realized the people who had really studied consciousness were the people who looked at their own consciousness. That's the way you study consciousness, not by studying the brain, but by observing your own consciousness. That's the way you study consciousness. And the people who've done that were the great spiritual sages, adepts, monks, recluses, people who've gone deep in meditation into observing their own being. And so that's how I got involved in meditation, in TM initially, and got fascinated by it and went out to India and lived in Rishikesh in northern India for a while. And that was really a turning point for me. Because I say, up until that time, I'd rejected religion. It's all just a load of weird Stone Age mumbo-jumbo. But what I realized just in India and through just deep meditation was that all religions, all spiritual traditions were all pointing in the same direction. And they'd all come from a similar source, people, individuals, having some awakening, some experience of their own true nature, which filled them with qualities of peace and love and deep contentment and coming back to that eternal present moment. And that experience was so powerful for them, and it's so life-changing, they obviously wanted to share it with other people, with those around them. And so they gathered students or friends, whatever. But then what inevitably happens is the people they were sharing their enlightenment or their wisdom with weren't quite as enlightened as they were. And so bits of it got misunderstood, bits of it got forgotten, bits got misinterpreted, and then when those people, those students, those monks, those disciples passed it on to other people, they didn't quite get their bit either, bits got added in. And so slowly, over time, that essential wisdom, that fire which gave birth to all traditions, gradually got diluted and misunderstood, and very often ended up appearing to be the exact opposite of what the initial teachers were trying to say. I think it's a bit like the old game of Chinese whispers, you know, where you pass a message around a room and it comes back totally different. I think that's what happened with the great spiritual insights, as they got passed on from one person to another, one culture to another, one language to a culture, until it ended up really very different. I sometimes jokingly call this truth decay. What happens to wisdom? It's truth decay. Or if I'm being more scientific, the entropy of wisdom. But my fascination became, what is that core wisdom in all the traditions? And that really became my mission for life. Part of my mission was just delving into that, and delving into it not just through reading different texts, but in my own experience, refining my own practice of meditation to see what was in there for myself in my experience. Because if that's where it all came from, was experience, then I had to go back and rely upon my own experience as a source of that wisdom, that truth. And the other thing that became apparent at that time was that nearly all the problems we face, from personal problems, social problems, global environmental problems, they all come back in one way or another to human thinking, human values, human decision making. And in one way or another, those values, decision making, come from a very limited, short-sighted, egocentric mode of consciousness. And what all the great teachers were pointing to was this other way of being, this other mode of consciousness, which wasn't so self-centered, which wasn't so limited. And so it became apparent to me that this was probably the most important thing in the world today, is, as well as trying to deal, manage all the problems that we were seeing in the world, as well as that, we needed to get back to the root problem in all of this, which was human consciousness. So coming back to really exploring human consciousness. And that's been my life in one way or another. I came back from India and set up a meditation center. It was actually a meditation center and organic whole food restaurant, one of the first ones in Cambridge. We used to joke, we fed the bodies downstairs, we fed the mind upstairs. But that's been really what I've been fascinated by, is this thing of what is awareness, and how do we, what does it mean to awaken? What is that really about, and how can we facilitate that? And that's really what I want to talk about tonight and tomorrow. I've called it effortless being, for reasons which should become apparent soon. But maybe first to say a few words about being. I use the word being because it's the most neutral word I can find for the essence of everything. You know, you could talk about it as God or Brahman or pure consciousness, but they're all labels that sort of have other associations connected with them. Being for me just says what is. Being is what is. And so that's why I use the word being. It's just the essence of everything is isness. It exists. Now, science, in its analysis of being, ends up looking at things like space, time, matter, energy, which it doesn't really know what they are, but they're labels it uses. And then as it delves into, we'll talk about this a bit later maybe, but as it delves into what it thinks space, time, matter, energy is, they all seem to dissolve and disappear. And I think they're approaching in their own way just an understanding of being and how it appears to us as space, time, matter and energy. But what I want to talk about here really is the personal side of that, because the essence of everything is our own essence. It is our own being. So what is it? What is our own being? There's a question which often goes around in spiritual circles, the inquiry, who are you? Who am I? Ramana Maharshi talked about a lot, but so many other teachers as well. And there used to be, there may still be, there used to be workshops, I remember 20, 30 years ago in the States, called Enlightenment Intensives, where you sat down opposite another person and you just asked the question, who are you? And you had to say, you know, who am I? Who are you? And you do this for hours. And you start off, you know, the obvious answers, you know, oh, I am Peter Russell. Yeah, okay, I am male. I am British. Except now I'm also American. But I am this, I am that. And but you go deeper and you realize, no, you're not those things. They're just names you have, just the body I have, just the nationality I have. You keep on asking, who are you? Who are you? And you get deeper and deeper. But it's a sort of, it's like a Zen koan. You know, Zen koans are these sort of unanswerable questions. But asking the question leads to a realization. And almost the trick in that question of who am I is the word who, because it immediately distracts you. Who am I? You start thinking who. You start thinking of all these different things you are. And then eventually the mind sort of breaks down and you realize that's all wrong. A more appropriate question might be, what are you? But again, the mind gets caught up in that and you start coming up with answers like, oh, what am I? I am a spiritual being having an earthly experience, or I am a droplet of divinity. And you can go on for a long time with all these nice ideas. I like to drop both the who and the what and ask the question, are you? And what's the answer to that? Anyone? Yes, the answer is yes, I am. And that, in a way, is the first person statement of being. The third person is it is, second person is you are, the first person is I am. That is the first person experience of being, is I am. And that takes absolutely no effort. You don't have to put any effort into being, or even into recognizing your being, that you are. It's just so obvious. It's probably the only thing of which we are absolutely 100% sure. The only thing which we are certain. The one great truth is, I am. Or we could even actually, to be more accurate, drop the I. Because that immediately I brings in ideas of ego, self, identity. Probably the ultimate truth is just am. Or as some just like to put it, amming. We are amming. There is amming. And I think that's what Descartes was pointing to with his famous line, cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am. People misunderstand that. They think he was saying, my thinking, because I think, my thinking gives me a sense of existence. And there is a truth to that. We certainly derive a sense of individual existence from our thinking. But he wasn't pointing to that. Like many philosophers, he was looking for what is the ultimate truth. And he realized, or not realized, but he developed what he called his method of doubt. And he said, whatever is absolutely true must be beyond any doubt whatsoever. And he sat down one evening to see what is it he couldn't doubt. And he realized he could doubt all his philosophies, anybody else's philosophies. He could doubt everything he'd ever said, he'd written. And he began to even doubt that he was awake. He thinks, well, maybe I'm asleep right now, having a dream. Maybe I'll wake up from this dream. I don't know. It's happened before. So he was doubting that he was actually awake. And he said, I can doubt all these thoughts. Maybe there's some demon in my mind putting these thoughts here. And then he realized what he couldn't doubt was that he was doubting and that he was thinking. And that proved that because he was thinking, therefore, I am. Although he didn't even use the word I, it's just sum in Latin is am. Because there's thinking, therefore, the ultimate truth is am, is being. So that's coming at the same thing from a Western philosophical point of view. So what I want to do tonight and tomorrow is look at what I consider to be some of the fundamentals of being, of this sense of am, or the fundamentals, if you like, of being aware, the fundamentals of being conscious. And, well, very briefly what they are, the first one I want to look at is the fundamental motivation of being. and then want to look at the fundamental belief in being, the fundamental awakening of being, and the fundamental practice of being. So that's what I want to cover. So the fundamental motivation of being is very simple. It's to be happy, to be at peace. The Dalai Lama once said, in the final analysis, the hope of every person is simply peace of mind. Everything we do because in one way or another, we think we're going to find peace, we're going to feel better. We may not use the word peace, it could be happiness, contentment, joy, ease. Whatever we do, we're doing it because we want to feel better inside. And it's even there, you know, in the chant, Om, Shanti, 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 peace, peace, peace. It's what we want. It's what we want for the world, it's what we want for others, and it's what we want for ourselves, to be at peace. And I'd say everything you do, in one way or another, you're doing it hoping you'll feel better for it. You know, we eat because it feels better than being hungry. You go for a swim because you enjoy it, you like it. Yoga, I hope you enjoy it. We live our lives, we go to work. We may not enjoy work, we may enjoy work, but we know by doing that, life becomes more enjoyable in the long term. When we help other people, you help somebody drops something, you pick it up for them. We get a sense of well-being from that. Or even things we don't like. I mean, if you go to the dentist, you know, that's not necessarily a pleasant experience, but we put up with a little bit of temporary unpleasantness because we know down the road we're probably going to feel a lot better for it. So that's our real bottom line, is actually how we feel. Our bottom line is not the financial bottom line, as our culture would have us think. The real bottom line is our state of consciousness, how we feel. Do we feel good? Do we feel okay? That's what we're looking for in everything. That's why we meditate. It may not always be easy, but ultimately, I mean, one of the goals of meditation is bliss consciousness, which I think is probably a mistranslation, or sort of a slightly off translation, which crept in when the very earnest European explorers and professors and people discovered the East several hundred years ago. They went out and like these completely new religions, completely different languages, and they obviously had these different practices, and they came across the word Ananda, and it got translated as bliss, which in English means this, you know, we have this idea of this sort of ecstatic, exotic, you know, completely transforming, taking you out of your body, joy, which can happen. Yes, that can happen in meditation. But the actual root meaning, when you get down to the Sanskrit roots, it actually means great contentment, deep contentment, great satisfaction. And that's what, you know, that's one of the things we find in meditation. You know, when the mind becomes really still, in that stillness, there can be that true great contentment where you couldn't possibly want anything else to be added. It's like, that'd be ridiculous. How could I want anything else? It's so perfect. It's often called perfection. In fact, the word perfection means everything has been done. Nothing else needs to be done. Nothing else needs to be added. And that, I think, is our natural state of mind. That's our natural state of being. And the other side of that, a parallel thing that we're looking for with peace is love. And I think they're very closely connected. And the hippies were right in a way. It is all about peace and love. That's what we want, peace and love. Love, there's many, many different ways we use the word love. But I think common to them all is a deep sense of okayness, of ease. It's like if the mind is at peace, if we're not worrying, we're not thinking, if the mind is at peace, the correlating experience in the body, in our feelings, is one of openness, acceptance, of love, compassion. Love has that quality of everything is okay. If it's, you know, romantic love, you meet the person who, finally I feel at home, they match all my needs, they're the perfect person, whatever it is. You feel okay. Or loving somebody, is that like that caring, accepting somebody as they are. Or there's that agape, the unconditional love that can happen in spiritual experience, where there's love which is not, it's unconditional, not in the sense that some people talk about unconditional love, you know, I love you anyway, I love you despite the fact that you leave the dishes in the sink. That's one sort of unconditional love. But the spiritual unconditional love is love that isn't about anything. It isn't loving anything or any person. It's just love that's welling up from within. It's just there. And I think when we are truly at peace, then we are truly in love, in the sense that we are in touch with that love that is our true nature. So I see peace and love are actually our true nature, innate qualities. They're qualities of the unconditioned mind, the mind that is not caught up in worry or concern or thinking. When we let go of all that, then we fall back into this natural state. So this is what I call natural mind. The mind in its natural state. It's not the normal state of mind. I mean, the normal state of mind of most people is not being at peace. We're worried, we're thinking, we're doing this, or whatever. When I say natural, it's the mind in its unperturbed state, when there's nothing to worry about. When everything is fine, we feel fine. There's a natural correlation between our physical well-being and how we feel inside. If we're fed, if we're not hungry, we're not cold, there's no danger, there's no threat, if everything is okay in the world around us, if we're safe, there's no threats to our survival, there's nothing we need, if everything is okay in the world around us, then we feel inside, we naturally feel okay inside. It's just a natural correlation. We feel content. We feel content. And that, to me, that contentment, or the deep contentment of Ananda, is our natural state. Then what happens is something, we, you know, let's say we're hungry. We move out of contentment into discontent. And it's quite natural. We feel discontent, things aren't right, I'm hungry, I need food, and we do something about it. We eat some food, go and find some food, whatever it is, go to the refrigerator. We eat something in order to return to contentment, in order to come back to balance, to come back to well-being. So that's why we are always seeking peace, ease, happiness, whatever you want to call it. Because underneath we are seeking to come back to contentment. We are seeking to do something in the world, change something, improve something, find something, so that we can deal with whatever is needed, whatever we're feeling, whatever we're feeling discontent, so that we can come back to that natural state of contentment. So that's the motivation of being, is to come back to feeling okay, whatever words we want to use. And so we are doing things in the world, changing the world, in order that we can come back to this natural state of being. But when we move into discontent, we start moving into thinking about things, what needs to be done, solving problems. Our mind starts becoming focused. We start worrying or planning, whatever it is. And what also happens is that the seamless experience of consciousness gets divided into me and it. The sense of an independent, separate self begins to arise. I mean, if you're just out, you know, looking at the sunset across the water, if you're totally just there in the experience, there is no sense of self, me, I. There's just this. And there's the awareness of its beauty, its awe, whatever it is. That is just one seamless experience. But when there's something that's amiss, there's something that's not quite right, there's something that's needed, there's some threat, then we divide our experience into this me here, body. Body has needs, body needs taken care of, and there's the world out there that needs to be changed, manipulated, or sometimes not changed, kept the same, whatever it is. We move into this mode that how the world is determines how I feel inside. And again, it's quite natural. It's quite a natural thing to do. All of this is really how consciousness works to help us survive. It's about moving into discontent because there's something wrong, moving back into contentment. And it should be just a natural alternation. Do-be-do-be-do-be-do. Be, something needs to happen, you do something, you come back to being. You do something, come back to being. Except that with human beings, we seem to spend all our time doing. I mean, our life isn't do, be, do, be. It's do, 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 be. Do, 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 finally be. And it's just, it's all about the doing. As people sometimes say, we become human doings rather than human beings. And yet, now the paradox is, we are smart, we like to think we're smart, we're intelligent, we have developed amazing technologies to do almost anything we want, we're creative. You know, we don't, if we're hungry, we just say go to the fridge to get some food. If we're cold, we put on some warmer clothes. We don't have to fend off wild animals most of the time. We build lovely shelters to keep ourselves dry. We live in incredible comfort. You'd think with all that technology, with all that comfort, It should just be, we should just be being the whole time with the occasional doing. It should be be, 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 oh, do, be, 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 do. But we're not. That's the almost the irony of human beings. I mean, your cat, Meenakshi's cat, is actually probably at peace much more than any of us. She's probably the most peaceful being in the ashram. And he's got no technology. Does get fed, yes, and stroked. Look at other animals, not just cats, dogs. You know, you've got pets, dogs. You know, if they've got nothing to do, they just sit there with their chin on the ground, watching the world go round. Other animals are happy most of the time. They're content most of the time. And here we are, we're so busy doing, looking for contentment, we hardly ever are content. This is the almost the irony, I sometimes call it the sad joke of being human. We're so busy wondering, working out how to be happy, that we never actually give ourselves the chance to be happy. Because if you're caught up in discontent and all of that, then you can't actually be resting in peace, almost by definition. A worried mind is not a mind that is at peace. So that's the question which I think many, many spiritual teachers have come to address, is why is it we spend our lives suffering? This was the first noble truth of Buddhism, dukkha. Dukkha in Pali and in Sanskrit, again, is often, well, was translated as suffering. And the sort of the naive idea when sort of these early explorers started coming back from the East was, oh, the Buddha said life is suffering and you just had to put up with it. Yeah, life is suffering, period. He wasn't actually saying that at all. The word dukkha is interesting. It was translated as suffering. The word dukkha is actually a negation in Pali of the word sukha. It means not sukha. And sukha, interestingly, means to be content, to be at ease, to be at peace. So what the Buddha was saying when he said we all suffer is not that that's just the nature of life and put up with it. What he's saying is we all experience discontent. And why is this? Why are human beings the most discontented species on the planet? What's gone wrong here? So this is where we get into the second fundamental, which is, I call it the fundamental belief, but it's also in a way the fundamental error. I sometimes like to think all beliefs are errors in a way. When we believe something, it's like the truth is true and doesn't need to be believed. When we believe something, it's something we don't quite know whether it's true or not, but we're going to hold on to that mindset, that view, because it seems to make sense. And the fundamental belief that really runs our culture is the belief about how do we go about finding happiness, how do we go about finding peace of mind, love, what we want. And the belief that runs us says that whether or not we feel okay inside depends upon what we have or do. That inner well-being depends upon having or doing the right things. Which can be true if the reason you're not at peace, as I say, is if you're hungry or cold, there's something wrong, there's some threat. In those few situations, it's true. But we've got caught up in this belief that any time we feel at ease, at unease, we don't feel at ease, any time we're not feeling at peace, we need to do something about it. You know, go to a movie, take a road trip, take up a new sport, do something. Do something. It's always about doing something. If we could just do enough of the right things, we'd finally be happy. That's the belief that drives our culture. And it's really sort of almost hypnotized into us from the moment we're born. This idea that if you're not happy, you need to have something, do something. I mean, it was there with my parents because they were brought up in that culture. They passed it on to me. Although I do remember a time when I was in my mid-20s and I'd just been to visit my parents for a weekend and I was leaving, about to get in the car to go away, and my mother decided it was about time she gave me a little pep talk. She said, you know, well, you've been to university, you did well, you've got all these degrees, and you went to India, you did all that, and you know, you studied meditation, you've done all those great things. Don't you think now it's about time you got a J-O-B? And I was still in my reactionary phase and said, well, why? Why should I get a job? She said, well, you know, there become times when you want to buy a house, you want to get married, you want to go on nice vacations. And everything she said, I kept on saying, why? And she kept on, you know, coming up with reasons. And then finally, I asked why one too many times, or maybe just once enough times. And she said, well, so that you can be happy, of course. I remember saying to her, well, aren't I happy? And this look came across her face, and it's like, oh, yes, yes, yes. And from then on, most of the time, she said, as long as you're happy, that's the main thing. Though she occasionally added, but I still think you'd have been better off taking that job with IBM. But it's not, it's in our education. Our education is mostly about this. It's in the media. It's just endemic in our culture. Ralph Waldo Emerson said, society is in conspiracy. And he said, against the manhood of every one of its members. But he was talking 100 years ago. I would rephrase that society is in conspiracy against the beingness of every one of its members. Advertising totally preys upon this. I mean, every single advertisement you ever see is basically saying you cannot be happy. It's telling you to be discontent in some way or another. You haven't got the right furnishing, you haven't got the right clothing, you haven't got whatever it is, enough money invested or whatever it is. It's basically telling you to be discontent. It's breeding discontent. And then it's saying, but buy this product, get this new credit card, go on vacation here, whatever it is, go to Atlantis, and you will be happy. It's just since our culture is run on advertising, it's just so endemic. It's saying, you can't be happy as you are. Here's discontent for you. We're going to give you another reason to be discontent, and then we're going to sell you the answer. That's what Emerson meant, I think, when he said society is in conspiracy against all its members. This is why we love money so much. I mean, money itself is nothing to be loved, but it gives us the power to buy the things, the opportunities, the friendships that we think will make us happy. One of my favorite lines is from a Rai Kuda song, who said, all the money in the world is spent on feeling good. again, it's that bottom line. That's what we're looking for ultimately, is how to feel better. This is the true meaning of samsara, the Indian word samsara. It literally means to wander on endlessly. Just endless wandering on, wandering on. We wander on from one thing to another, from one temporary satisfaction to another temporary satisfaction, hoping, or rather believing, that you know, each one, if we just got enough of this, we'll be happy. Just got enough of this, we'll be happy. That's the belief that just drives us on in this world. The whole world is out there, is samsara. That endless seeking out there for actually our true nature, which is here. That's what we get caught in. And it doesn't work. I mean, it seems to work temporarily. You know, you go and buy something, you go shopping. I mean, shopping, I was just amused coming in at the airport. There's a big sign saying, come to the airport 3 hours early when you leave and shop. Because then you're going to spend some money and you're going to be happier. What happens when you buy something? So supposing, you know, you buy a new jacket or something. You feel good at the time. You think it's the buying the jacket. You think it's that has made you feel better. You think it's the jacket that's made you feel better. But actually it isn't. And this is where I think the internet has a very subtle but valuable teaching for us when we start shopping online. Because when you shop online, you don't actually get the jacket immediately. But when you feel good is the moment you press that button that says buy now. Nothing's changed except your credit card has been immediately debited in one nanosecond. You should be feeling bad because your bank account has just dropped $100. But no, you feel good. And you feel good because you've had this discontent, this artificially created discontent that says, I don't have the right jacket, and you've sorted out the colour, the shape and everything, and finally you've decided upon it. You press buy now. That little particular discontent has now been dealt with. But you can rest assured that pretty soon there's going to be another discontent to come up, and you'll be dealing with that one, then another discontent, then another discontent. And of course, when it finally does arrive, you realise it isn't quite the colour you thought it was going to be, or it doesn't quite fit, or whatever, and you're back into another discontent. That's how we live our life, just discontent, some temporary satisfaction, discontent, another temporary satisfaction. That's samsara. And I think that's why I'm going to pause for tonight. I want to go on tomorrow looking more about how that gives rise to the whole ego mode of operating. And then, as I say, the fundamental insight, the fundamental awakening that breaks through all this, that begins to undo all this, undoes the samsara. And then what I see is the essential path, the essential way to coming back to living our true nature. But thank you for now.